Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Buying Tickets ADA Ticketing Regulations and You conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Robin Jones. You may begin.
Thank you, and good morning and good afternoon to all of you as you are joining us from different parts of the country. I want to welcome you to the ADA Audio Conference Series, which is sponsored by the ADA National Network. This is one of our programs that we offer covering a variety of topics related to the Americans with Disabilities Act. As you heard from the operator, today's session is going to be focusing on the ticketing regulations. Our focus today will be primarily looking at how does this really affect the individual and what their needs are or that they need to know about the changes that have taken place under the revisions to the Department of Justice regulations, specifically related to the ticketing industry at a variety of different venues, whether it be sports or arts or other areas where you might purchase tickets to participate. We have two wonderful speakers today, and before I introduce them, I just want to go over a few of the logistics of the program. We have people participating today in a variety of different methods and modes. We have individuals who are participating solely by telephone, listening to us as we talk today. There are individuals who are also joining us by what we call streaming audio on the Internet. And then we have also individuals who are using the online webinar platform to view the slides and follow along with us today. Each of these options provide different ways for people to ask questions. Those of you that are on the telephone and would wish to ask a question via the telephone, our operator, when we're ready to take questions, will direct you on how to do that. Those of you that are participating by streaming audio on the Internet, you will use the interface that's available to you on that system to submit your questions. Individuals who are on the webinar platform, which also includes individuals who are using captioning today, can submit your questions either by telephone if you are connected to the telephone, and or you can submit them by the chat room that is available to you in the webinar platform. We'll be monitoring all of these ways to take your questions, and so we will be feeding those to our speakers today. The session is being recorded, and it will be available as an archive, so both a written archive as well as an audio archive. Within 10 days of the end of the session, which gives us time to edit the transcript and such and get it up on to the ada-audio.org website. So before I lose too much time in the session today, I want to go ahead and just introduce our speakers, and then I will be turning it over to them to deliver the content today. First, we have Cleo King, who is the Senior Vice President of Accessibility Services at United Spinal Association. Cleo has worked for a long time in the field of disability as a legal advisor and attorney, primarily in the areas of housing, air transportation, and access to public cases. She's also active in the regulatory process involving the rights of people with disabilities. She has served with the American Bar Association on different programs that they have to offer. She's been involved in the New York City Bar Association Committee on Legal Issues Affecting People with Disabilities, and she was also a member of the United States Access Board's Courthouse Advisory Committee. Some of the assignments that she's working on and has been assigned to within the United Spinal Association is developing ticket policies for accessible seating with numerous professional sports teams and entertainment venues, ensuring that new venues comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act and local building code requirements, including the Jazz Center at Jazz at Lincoln Center, City Field, the New York Yankee Stadium, and the Target Field. She also has worked with PepsiCo, reviewing their facilities for usability for people with disabilities. She has a lot of very extensive experience and has worked, again, in housing and other areas as well. Our second speaker is Betty Siegel, and she is Manager of Accessibility with the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. She has specialized in arts and disability issues for over 25 years, and she started in the field at Area Stage in Washington, D.C., moved to Austin, Texas, where she ran a small arts and disability nonprofit and was certified as a sign language interpreter. She's currently the Director of Accessibility at the John F. Kennedy Center for Performing Arts in D.C. and oversees all of their accessibility compliance, policies, and accommodations for all performance programs, events, and facilities associated with the John F. Kennedy Center. She initiates and works on a national and international projects, such as the Leadership Exchange in Disability, Arts and Disability, also known to or referred to as LEAD, Network of Cultural Arts Administrators. And she currently, recently, not too long ago, got her JD degree and is currently licensed to practice law in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I see you can see by the background, and both of their bios are on our website, so you can read more information about both of them if you wish to get some more information, are very qualified in this particular area, and we're very pleased to have them join us today. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead, and I'm going to turn over the microphone to Cleo, and she'll start us out today. Go ahead, Cleo.
Thank you, Robin. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm on the East Coast, so it's afternoon for me. As Robin said, we're going to give you an overview of the ticketing regulations that came out in September 15th of 2010 under the revised Department of Justice ADA regulations. And I'm just going to give you a couple of sites for those who don't have access to the slides. Title II, State and Local Government. The regulations are found at 28 CFR Part 35, and for Title III, Places of Public Accommodation, the regulations are at 28 CFR Part 36. The regulations, as I said, were published on September 15, 2010. They became effective or enforceable on March 15, 2011, just about 2 months ago, and the regulations also reference the ADA standards for design, which will become effective next March, March 15, 2012, and that affects the design for new construction and alteration in projects. So what we're doing today is we're going to focus on the ticketing section of those regulations. And the regulations cover basically eight areas, which we'll get into in more detail, but I was going to just give you a summary of the eight areas. First, there's ticket sales. Then there's the identification of available accessible seating, ticket pricing, purchasing of multiple companion seats, release of accessible seats, transfer of tickets to third parties, acquiring tickets in the secondary market, and finally, regulations outlining fraud prevention. So first, what type of tickets are covered? Basically, single event tickets, series of events tickets, whether it's a subscription to the opera, season tickets for a football game, or season tickets for the baseball season. So that's series of event tickets. Then there's season tickets, subscription tickets, and event packages. So basically, anytime a venue sells tickets, whether it's some type of a package, a single event, or a series of events, that are covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act and have to comply with the regulations. Next slide. Ticket sales, wheelchair companion seats, the accessible seatings are defined as a wheelchair seating area as well as the individual companion seats. A wheelchair seating area is basically a term of art. It's a section that it has specific dimensions. 36 inches wide, and if you enter the seating area either from the front or the rear, it's 48 inches in depth. And if you have to enter from the side, that is, you come into the seating area and have to make a turn in order to face the stage or the performance area or the field, it is 60 inches wide by 60 inches deep by the 36 inches wide. And if there are two wheelchair seating areas adjacent to each other, the accessible seating is 33 inches for each wheelchair user. So that, when we say accessible seating, the wheelchair space, that's what that means, those particular dimensions. And then, of course, accessible seating also means that there's companion seats adjacent to the wheelchair location. Also, for ticket sales, everyone has to have equal opportunity to purchase the tickets. So that means that if the tickets go on sale at the box office, via telephone, or online, the wheelchair, the accessible seating also has to be able to be purchased in those various venues. And at the same hours of operation, so again, if the box office is open from 8 to 4, the wheelchair or the accessible seating locations also are on sale for those times, as well as online at various ticket outlets and other in the mall or other types of venues.
Cleo, this is Betty. I want to jump in on this slide and emphasize again the fact that in Section 1, what they do is they define what this section of the regulations is talking about, and they are only talking about in this section of regulations, they are only talking about the wheelchair accessible locations as well as the companion seats. This section is not intended to, nor does it cover, seating for patrons who are deaf, seating for patrons who are blind or have low vision. So the regulations have are only addressing the wheelchair accessible locations and seating for visitors and patrons who have mobility disabilities.
Right, exactly. That's a very good point to remember throughout the presentation for this section. Next slide.
Oops, I got to get there. There we go.
The second section is the identification of accessible seating. Again, this is the availability, the locations, the various features, the same. What this section means in the regulation is that if a person does go online to purchase tickets and they can see the map or there's a brochure describing the various sections, that it has to be identical for the accessible seating as well as for the non-accessible seating. So if there is a map where you can click on to see, you know, where you're purchasing your seat, whether it's on the aisle or in the middle of a row, the same is true for the accessible seating. You have to be able to identify that in the same manner as you would the non-accessible seating.
Cleo, it's Betty again. I get to jump in. I have the fun job of just being able to let you do all the work, and then I get to jump in. One of the things that I think is really important for patrons and people with disabilities who are taking advantage of this section of the regulations is the concept of on request. Keep in mind that if you call a venue and you are asking about purchasing tickets, you can ask that venue to identify the availability of all those seating locations. They don't have to just do it, but if you request it, then they have to respond by giving you the location of all available accessible seating at the time that you call.
So it would basically be they would be giving the availability for what's still on sale.
That's correct. And that's really an important new element this regulation introduces for people with disabilities, because you don't have to just take the venue's word for it any longer. Oh, yeah, this is all we have. You can say to them, can you identify all of the available seating right now? And then they're going to have to give you that whole list.
Based on where they're located, the price range, various different features, that kind of thing, correct?
That's correct.
And I think another really key concept under this section is the website. Websites where people go to purchase tickets now have to be identical for people who are purchasing the accessible seats. If you are able to click on the two seats that you want, and, you know, then the next step is entering credit card information, it has to be identical for people purchasing the accessible seating.
Now, Cleo, it's Betty again to jump in. When you say identical, do you mean exactly the same? I think with online ticketing, there might be some cases where You actually have to do a couple of additional clicks, but nothing that's onerous or burdensome in order to get to the wheelchair accessible locations.
Right. And also, they can also, if you click on, say, wheelchair accessible seating location, it can tell you, you know, this seating is for someone who uses a wheelchair. You will remain in your wheelchair in this seat. So there is, when I said identical, what I meant was in the past there has been some online ticketing for various venues where you would fill out a form and then someone from the venue would call you and that's how you would complete your purchase. Now you are able to complete your purchase online. As a person who is purchasing a seat that's not an accessible seat.
Yeah, that helps a lot because in the past a lot of places did have you fill out an online form that then you actually were submitting via email, and then after the fact somebody would call you back and say, oh, we got your form. Now we'll sell you the ticket. Now we hope that most people are going to get their ticketing online in real time so that a person with a disability is purchasing their tickets in the same manner that everybody else is doing.
Right, and I think that's a good phrase, real time. That's really the key.
Yeah. One of the other things I think, and I think you touched on this a little bit, Cleo, was this concept of what's the feature of the accessible seating. For me, a feature of the accessible seating is that it's a location where there probably is no chair or there's a removable chair. It has certain dimensions, either 36 inches, like you mentioned, by 48 or 60, or sometimes they can be 33 inches wide by 48 or 60 inches if you have two wheelchair locations adjacent to one another.
Correct. And the next slide kind of does go into the accessible features.
Oh, should we jump there?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, there they are.
So it's the clear floor space that we had both talked about, the 36 by the either 48 or 60 dimension, depending on the approach to the space. It's on an accessible route. The companion seat and the wheelchair location have shoulder-to-shoulder alignment. They're at the same elevation. And then the size, quality, comfort of amenities is equal to that of other seats in the area. So if other seats in the area have cup holders, the wheelchair locations and the companion locations have cup holders. If the companion location is a removable seat, which is now is now permitted in the regulations, the quality of the removable seat has to be the same quality of the seating in that section. So if you have a padded seat with padded arms, your companion seat has to be similar. It can't be, you know, a folding metal chair.
Not very much fun to watch an opera for 3 or 4 hours sitting on a folding metal chair.
Right, exactly. So I think that you'll be seeing, you know, and again, based on price range, the quality of the seat may go up or down. You may have, say, in a ballpark, you may have seats that have the padded vinyl covering, but then you also may have just the metal seats. So the companion seat in that area would be the same as seats surrounding it. So a companion seat in a venue could differ depending on which section you're sitting in. And I think next slide, please.
Okay.
Ticket prices.
Do I get to cover this one, or are you taking over?
You can. You get to cover it.
This is Betty again. Highlights in this one are relatively simple, but they get a little complex because you can never separate the ticket pricing from the venue itself. The regulations are pretty specific, and they say that ticketing for a wheelchair user in wheelchair locations have got to be available at the same price levels as everybody else has the opportunity to purchase. So available at all price levels. And then it goes on to address the situations where you might be in an older venue, a venue that hasn't engaged any barrier removal, a venue that hasn't done any renovations. And it says if you cannot physically get your wheelchair users into all of your sections, then you should be looking at the wheelchair locations you do have and price them proportionally to the rest of the theater. The one caveat on that is that you cannot price a wheelchair location any higher than the section in which it is located. So on this slide, I'm going to describe it to you for those that don't have this visually. There is a very simple floor plan of a theater that's divided into three sections, an orchestra section, which is usually the first floor level of the theater, a mezzanine that's usually up one level, and a balcony, which would be your third level. In this theater, we're presuming that all of the wheelchair locations are located in the orchestra. This is not an unusual situation for older venues. Frequently, they don't have even elevators that would take you up to the other levels. So this pretend venue has all of its wheelchair locations, eight of them, in the orchestra. No wheelchair locations in the mezzanine or balcony, actually not even really any access there. And the seating in this theater, though, is priced by location. So you have $100 tickets in the orchestra, $50 tickets in the mezzanine, and $25 tickets in the balcony. So what's a theater supposed to be doing in this situation? It's supposed to look at the eight wheelchair locations, which is 100% of all the wheelchair locations in the building, that are all located in the orchestra level. And then it's supposed to price them proportionally, because remember, the orchestra tickets are all $100. Everybody else who doesn't need a wheelchair accessible location could choose to purchase a cheaper ticket in the balcony or the mezzanine at $25 and $50 respectively. But the wheelchair user really only has one choice of location. So we want to try to give them the opportunity to also choose from all three price ranges. So you price proportionally in a theater with eight wheelchair locations. If 50% of the seats in the entire building are in the orchestra, you're going to take 50% of those eight wheelchair locations, which in this case would be four, and you're going to price them to $100. The mezzanine has 25% of the available seats in the building. And so we're going to take 25% of the wheelchair locations and price them at 50. So that gives me two wheelchair locations at 50. And then the balcony has 25% of all the seats. And so I'm going to take the remaining two tickets in my orchestra section, price them proportionally to $25. So I end up with wheelchair locations all in the orchestra, where typically the seats are $100, four seats at $100, two seats at $50, and two seats at $25. Now, let's do, just for fun, the opposite scenario where you have all of your wheelchair locations in the balcony. What can you do there? Well, the balcony tickets are $25, and since I cannot price my wheelchair locations any higher than the section in which they physically reside, I'm going to have to price all those wheelchair locations at $25. That's about the most math that any theater person ever wants to have to do. So I hope that didn't just totally confuse everybody. And if it did, ask questions, and we'll address it at the end of the presentation. But this is a really new concept for you all that are out there purchasing these tickets. You're going to want to be looking at the percentages and the distribution of the wheelchair locations as compared to all the rest of the seats in the venue, and that's going to affect how those tickets get priced. I think for the user, and Cleo, if you jump in on this, that might be useful. I think for the user, it's going to get a little confusing because you may end up sitting, for example, in this scenario, if you're a wheelchair user, the person sitting next to you may have paid $100 for the tickets, you paid $50, and the person over on the other side paid $25. And that happens because that venue is allowed to price those seats proportionally to the rest of the theater.
Right. Now, that does happen, and some, you know, it depends on where the seats, like you say, are located. If they're all in one section, it's a lot harder to, price it according to the the quality of the seat. But again, the person is sitting in the orchestra, which would be a better seat at a lower price. Is there any, and the way that, Betty, this you as a venue operator, I was going to ask a question. Is there any progress on how they have to sell the seats? Like, do they have to sell the 25 before the 50 and then before the 100, or does it depend on what the patron is asking when they call up to purchase the ticket?
I think that the best practice in this area is going to be to take your guidance from the patron, because the venue should be saying, you know, you want tickets for Wicked on June the 18th. We have tickets available at $100, $50, and $25. Now, they could stop right there, and the patron would have to say, oh, I'm interested in the $25 tickets. Hopefully the venue, because they are good customer service people, will then go on to say, and all of those tickets for wheelchair users are in the orchestra level. Mm-hmm. So as long as we have $25 tickets available, there's probably no advantage to you of buying the $100 tickets at this point. But they may sell them out. And this is goes back to that other section where it gives you the right to ask what the availability of the tickets are, because if they just say we have $100 tickets, you have the right to say, can you tell me the availability of all the wheelchair locations and what the prices are.
Right, and that I would recommend that people who are purchasing the wheelchair locations, especially in older venues that probably don't have the wheelchair locations spread out at every level, to ask specific questions. Where are your $100 tickets located? Where are your $50 tickets located, et cetera? And then that way you're very well informed and you would see, well, the $100 tickets are, you know, orchestra center, the $50 are orchestra left, and the $25 are orchestra right. And now you have a choice. Where would you like, you know, to actually purchase? Which seat would you like, and how much would you like to spend? So the more information that you get from the venue, I think that the purchase will be exactly what the individual wanted and needed.
Right. As a venue, we don't want you being surprised when you show up. I would think that the best practice for venues is going to be to volunteer that information. But if they don't volunteer it, you have a right to ask for it.
Right, exactly. So definitely be proactive and ask questions.
Absolutely. Shall we move on?
Yes, purchasing of multiple tickets. The regulations now specifically state that a person who is purchasing wheelchair seating location can purchase up to three companion seats, contiguous and in the same row, if, and the, this is a big if, capital IF, if they're available at the time of sale. So if an individual wants to purchase a wheelchair location and three companion seats in a certain section, certain row, and they're available, they're entitled to purchase the wheelchair location and the three companion seats contiguous to that location. If they're not available in that section, perhaps they can move on to another section to find the configuration that they need. But if someone has already purchased the adjacent seats, the venue does not have to move those people that already purchased. So, again, it's if those three companion seats are available at the time of sale. Now, with that being said, that doesn't mean that a wheelchair user who is purchasing the accessible seats can only purchase up to four seats. That's just the contiguous requirement and in the same row. So if a wheelchair user needs to purchase six seats, and one is the wheelchair location and the three companion seats that are adjacent, the other two seats can be located as close as possible. So it could be, you know, the row in front perhaps. So that's just an important number to remember, that the three companion seats are adjacent, contiguous as the regulations say. But a wheelchair user can purchase as many tickets as they want. Of course, if the venue, like for some concerts, the number of tickets is restricted for everyone who's coming to purchase tickets. So if the restriction is 2 tickets or 4 tickets, the restriction would be the same for individuals purchasing accessible seating. And Betty, from a venue point of view, is there any hints you want to add or other points?
I think that this is going to be another one of those new, one of the sections of the new regulations that's going to trip up a lot of people, both the venues and patrons who are purchasing tickets. The contiguousness, it's interesting. I looked up the definition, and contiguous just means touching, but the Department of Justice has clearly defined this as meaning in the same row. So when you're looking at companion seats, I'm not going to look, as a venue, I'm not going to look at the row behind you or the row in front of you. I'm going to look at just the row that you're in, because it says, and in the same row, to find those companion seats. If I can't find you up to 3 companion seats are contiguous and in the same row, then I'm going to start looking as close as possible. I hope the best practice of a theater is going to be to give you a lot of information at this point, because the closest seats to those wheelchair locations, if we go back to that previous example where you've got all your wheelchair locations in the orchestra in the $100 seats, the closest available seats to those wheelchair locations are going to be $100 tickets. So you might end up buying the $25 tickets, the 2 that are priced at $25, and you're looking for your other 2 companion seats, and the closest available seats might be 2 rows forward at $100. I hope at that point the venue is going to be saying to you as a patron, I have tickets that are 2 rows forward at $100, but I also still have seats available in the balcony if you would prefer to purchase the $25 balcony seats for your companions. And then leave it on you as the patron to say, what's more important to you? Is it more important to you that your companions be close and that you pay $100 for their seats, or that the companions be further away and you're only paying $25 for their seats? That's a real important choice that the patron is going to have to be making as they go along. Cleo, I was at another conference recently and someone asked me a question, and I had to explain to them that the 3 companion seats might also include purchasing an additional wheelchair location.
Correct.
And so the number of wheelchair locations that are available when I'm actually having to sell them to a wheelchair user and then use some of those locations as companion seats may be fewer than you're used to in the past.
Right. No, they could. And so if there are 2 wheelchair locations next to each other and a wheelchair user comes and asks to purchase the wheelchair location and 2 companions, perhaps the venue can infill the other wheelchair location with folding chairs in order to accommodate that person. And again, that's if it's available at the time that individual called to make their purchase.
Now, I also think one of the unintended consequences of this particular section of the regulations is that in the past, as a venue, I was going to hold tight to my wheelchair and my companion seat, and I was going to always make sure that they sold together as a pair. Under these new regulations, you as a wheelchair user might end up finding out that when you go to buy your tickets, there is no companion seat because somebody else before you purchased that companion seat as one of their 3 contiguous companion seats. And so you may find in the future that occasionally you're going to be told that there is only a wheelchair location with no companion seat that's contiguous to it and in the same row. And I think that's an unintended consequence of this particular part of the regulations.
Right. No, I agree. And so I guess the important point there is the quicker you purchase your tickets, the quicker you're going to get what you as an individual need. So it's basically first come, first serve.
Absolutely. I think every one of these sections has this a very key qualifier to it, which, and in this case, the key qualifier to your ability to purchase 3 companion seats is that it's if available at the time of sale. I think that's really something you have to keep in mind. So buy early and buy often.
Definitely. The next section kind of goes the next step, group sales. You're coming as a large group, whether it's, you know, a social group or a large family is buying a chunk of tickets, whatever, you know, the group sales, 10 or more tickets. The group, if there are one or more wheelchair users in the group, the group is seated near the accessible seating as close together if possible. If the group needs to be divided because there are not enough locations near the accessible seating to accommodate the group, then the group is divided, but the venue needs to be conscious that when they divide the group, they're not isolating the patron with a disability who has the accessible seats. So part of the group would stay with the person who needs the accessible seating, and the other part of the group would go elsewhere. So it's just, again, this is more for a ticketing and seating issue for the venue. If someone is purchasing group sale, then and they identify that they need accessible seating for individuals who are entitled and require the features of the accessible seating, the venue needs to deal with the group leader who's purchasing the tickets so that the person with a disability is not separated from their group completely. But again, the group may need to be divided, and just keep that in mind.
That's a good reflection of that section.
Okay, and do you have anything to add as the venue? Okay.
Nope.
Good. Highlights, Section 5, hold and release. So basically, a venue can release the accessible seats when all accessible seats, all non-accessible seats are sold out. If the non-accessible seats are sold out in the area, then you can release the accessible seats in that area or in that price range. So, for example, if the orchestra level in a venue where there are wheelchair locations in the orchestra, the mezzanine, and the balcony, and the orchestra sells out, the venue can release the wheelchair locations in the orchestra level. And while the wheelchair locations in the mezzanine and the balcony are still available because the mezzanine and balcony have not yet sold out, but as they sell out, they a venue is allowed to release the wheelchair seating in those locations or in those price ranges. And again, that's a venue is allowed to release. They don't have to. A venue can. And I have dealt with a few venues that refuse to release. If it's time of performance, they may have unsold wheelchair locations because they don't release their wheelchair or their accessible seating locations. Betty, I think I'm going to turn to you for the definition of sold out since that's a term of art for venues.
Absolutely. Here's the interesting thing about this section to keep in mind. The Department of Justice declined, if you read the appendix to these regulations, Appendix A, they actually talk about selling out and what does that mean. And the Department of Justice declined to define the terminology sold out. So the venue is left to decide what it means to be sold out. And here's the interesting thing about venues. Some venues define themselves as being sold out when absolutely every seat available is sold. In other words, there just aren't any other seats to sell. Some venues will call themselves sold out when they have a certain number of what we call single seats, meaning the seats are not together. There's no pairs of seats together. There's one seat in the upper left. There's one seat in the lower right section of the theater. There's one seat in the balcony. There's one seat in the boxes. Those single tickets are oftentimes hard for venues to sell because most people want to come and sit with the person they came with. And so the venue will say, well, we're sold out. even though they actually do have these single seats still available for sale. And at that point, if that's their definition of sold out, the Department of Justice has said, you get to pick the definition of sold out. And so if I define sold out as being at the point where all the seats that are in pairs are sold out, then at that point, I would be allowed to start to release my wheelchair locations. Another type of sold out that some venues use is they will define sold out based on percentages. So at the point that the venue is 95% sold out, they'll start calling that, then that they will start calling that performance a sellout. And by these regulations, at that point, the venue would be allowed to release the wheelchair locations. So I think the tricky thing here is that this regulation has made it so that every venue has to have the same policies in place to hold and release their tickets, but every venue may have a different definition of sold out. So there is no guarantee that as a wheelchair user, you're going to be able to call me an hour before the show starts and presume that I will have tickets left, because I may have released my wheelchair accessible locations because by my definition, I am sold out. So be careful about that one, because venues can release the tickets when they are sold out and they get to use their definition of sold out. They can't come up with ridiculous definitions. Oh, we're sold out when, oh, the left-hand section is sold out but not the right-hand section, or the third row is sold out but not the fifth row. It has to be a reasonable definition of sold out, and probably one that's fairly common for industry, sort of industry standard of sold out. But as soon as they're sold out, they can release those wheelchair accessible locations. The only other trick, Cleo, I think, with the sellouts is that a lot of times some venues will have seats that they call VIP seats, and those don't go on sale the same way the other seats go on sale. So if I have a lot of those kinds of tickets that basically I'm holding back for particular populations to purchase, and still, according to the DOJ in the appendix, but not necessarily, this isn't specified in the regulations themselves, I should hold back an equitable number of wheelchair locations so that when I release those other holds, I release my VIP holds, I'm releasing some wheelchair locations along with them. That's a really confusing concept, I think, for people who are not in the box office business or in the venue business. So, again, I think, like Cleo said earlier, as a patron, you're going to have to be pretty savvy. And when you call the venue to purchase your tickets, you need to take advantage of that opportunity to ask them to tell you what wheelchair accessible locations are available at the time that you're calling.
And I think, Betty, as you were talking, I was thinking the way tickets are sold sometimes. Sometimes a particular credit card will be able to do advance purchase if you're a card holder of American Express or Visa or whatever the card is. So at that point, I think that deal with, you know, if you're a particular card holder, not only do they have seats, but they also would have to include accessible seats within that promotion. And then when that promotion is over and they've sold out, at that point would they be able to release the accessible seats for that promotion, do you think?
I think they probably would be allowed to do that.
Okay, that's
because
what I
usually that promotion is a price type. So you're releasing the third condition under which I'm allowed to release is when I'm sold out in a price. So, and I think at the point that those holds are no longer existent, then I would also expect to release the wheelchair locations.
Okay, yep, that makes sense. The next slide is series of event tickets. And basically that, again, as we had said earlier, is maybe season tickets or some type of package or subscription where you're buying more than one performance or one game or one event. You're buying, you know, however it's sold, whether it's a season basis or, you know, some kind of a 10 performance package, something like that. If an individual buys series of event tickets, and at some point the venue sells out of their season tickets that are not accessible, they can release the accessible locations to a person without a disability. If the series, say a season ticket holder, next year can automatically resubscribe to their season, that would be fine if it's not the accessible locations. If the accessible locations were released because of a sellout in the 2011 season, then come the 2012 season, the person without the disability who bought the accessible seats doesn't have an automatic ownership right. So at that point, the venue would have to see if there is a person who wants to purchase the season tickets, if they've come forward, and, again, try to sell those that season ticket to a person with a disability. And then, again, if a person with a disability doesn't come forward for the 2012 season and all the other season tickets are sold out, they can release that season ticket package to a person without a disability. But it's not an automatic renewal, I think, is the point. And the information the venue gives to the individual purchasing the accessible location would include that information that they don't have ownership rights and it's not going to automatically be theirs again for the next season.
Cleo, we have that situation with our subscribers, and we are including little notices along with the person's resubscription sort of to that effect, stating these are wheelchair accessible locations. Please let us know if you continue to need these locations because a member of your party is a person with a mobility disability or requires the features of that space.
Okay. The next slide is transfer of accessible seating to third parties. And again, it's the same terms and conditions. So if an individual who has bought accessible seating because they needed the features in the accessible seating, but they transfer their ticket, maybe they can't go to the performance, something came up, and they give it to their neighbor who is not a person with a disability, doesn't need the features of the accessible seating, they're allowed to do that. But the venue is not required to relocate the patron without the disability.
I think, yeah. Cleo, for patrons, one of the things as a venue that we hear sometimes is a wheelchair user or somebody will go in and they'll look at the spaces that are wheelchair accessible and they'll say, I don't see anybody in a wheelchair sitting there. And this part of the regulation is going to make that happen perhaps more often, because if I'm a wheelchair user and I give my ticket to you, Cleo, and you go in using my accessible seating ticket, you're going to be sitting in a wheelchair accessible location. And when you look over there, you're going to see Cleo sitting there, and you're going to say, she's not a wheelchair user.
Right, exactly.
And I, as the venue, am going to say, I know, but she had the location, and that's where I had to seat her.
Right. And, you know, and I think Department of Justice did this because individuals who do need the accessible seating may purchase something, and if they can't go or they sell it to their neighbor, they give it to their neighbor, they're allowed to do that as a person without a disability who has a ticket to a performance and can attend, can give that ticket away. So, again, I agree with Betty. I've gotten complaints where people are telling me, you know, the wheelchair locations aren't used by the people who need them. But, again, the person sitting there might have legitimately come across the ticket. And so you can't just jump to a conclusion that, you know, they did not get the ticket legitimately. And we'll kind of touch upon that in a few more slides when we talk about fraud.
Absolutely.
And the next slide is about the secondary market. And this basically is any transaction after the initial purchase, so the venue puts their tickets on sale, people are buying tickets, but there's also the secondary market where, you know, maybe it is a sold-out a performance or event, and people go online and go to a secondary market and are able to purchase tickets. And so if a wheelchair location is purchased on the secondary market, again, the venue has to honor the ticket. If a person who needs accessible seating purchases a ticket on the secondary market and it's not an accessible location, and they go to the event or the performance and they realize they've bought seats that they cannot use, they can ask the venue to put them in a comparable location, and the venue can do that if the location is available. Betty, as the venue, you want to talk a little bit about the struggles you have when that occurs?
Absolutely. It's because again, this is an issue that as a patron, a purchaser of tickets, you're going to have to confront. So, let's say you do go onto eBay and you purchase two tickets and you get them in the mail and you notice that they are in a non-accessible location. You are going to want to present those tickets, and the terminology in the regulations talks about presentation of the ticket, and you're going to want to present that ticket to the venue as soon as you possibly can, because the caveat on this section is that the venue only has to make the exchange into a wheelchair accessible location if a comparable wheelchair accessible location is available at the time the ticket is presented. So you have to tie this back to that other section where we're talking about hold and release policies. And remember, I can let my wheelchair accessible locations go if I'm sold out. So if you walk into the theater at 5 minutes before the show's going to start and you say, here I am, I'm a wheelchair user and I've got inaccessible locations, I want you now to exchange these to a comparable location, I may say, I'm sorry, but I don't have those because I'm sold out and I released all my wheelchair accessible locations. So the best thing you can do as a patron is to present your tickets. And a presentation doesn't mean a physical presentation. If you call the box office 3 weeks before the show starts and you say, I've got these locations, they're not wheelchair accessible, I'd like to exchange them, the box office is going to have to make that exchange 3 weeks ahead of time. The sooner you can get those tickets or notify or basically present those tickets to the venue, the more likely you're going to get in to see the show, because it's more likely they'll have the tickets to exchange you into. Don't wait. Oh, please don't wait till 5 minutes before showtime. That can just be disastrous for all involved. So keep in mind, the important thing about this is you're entitled to have the venue honor that ticket that you purchased through eBay or any other secondary market, but only if I've got the tickets available when you present them to me. Cleo, what about the concept of comparable? If I've purchased tickets on eBay for the $25 seats in the balcony, would a comparable ticket be the $100 seats in the orchestra?
I would think that comparable would not mean that. But if they are available, perhaps the venue could offer that and see if the person wanted to upgrade. But then I've also dealt with venues who say if it's a time or performance and the seat's going to go empty, you know, I put the wheelchair user there because, you know, why, you know, turn him or her away when I have the seat sitting there empty. But, again, I think that's going to be a venue's choice because the balcony and the orchestra are not comparable. And then what happens if the reverse, I was going to ask you, Betty, if the person has the $100 ticket and comes in and you say, well, I'm sorry, the only wheelchair location I have available is the balcony and those are the $25 seats, it's not up to the venue to reimburse that person $75.
No, it definitely wouldn't be, because we weren't a part of the exchange to get those tickets.
Right. So the transaction and the issue is really with the secondary market, not with the venue. And, you know, the venue is now trying to accommodate the individual and try to find them either a comparable seat if it's available, so there's no issue. You bought a $100 ticket, you're in the $100 seats. But then, you know, if the venue says all I have left is the $50 seats, you know, that the patron has to decide, do they want to sit there, or do they want to, you know, not go to the performance, but then what's the likelihood that they're going to get any of their money back from a secondary market?
Probably zero.
Right.
In most venues, I think as a best practice, most venues, if a wheelchair user comes in with a non-accessible location, most venues are going to make every effort to accommodate that patron, but it's going to be based on what they've got available at the time the patron presents the ticket.
Exactly.
That's really key for you as wheelchair users and patrons using those tickets. Present your ticket as soon as you possibly can. We're on to the last slide, and I think this is timing out just perfectly, so we can do this final point, Cleo, and then move into Q&A.
Okay, good. Yeah, the final point is prevention of fraud, and that is always the hot topic whenever I've done a presentation like this. Fraud happens. There are people out there that aren't nice people who call up and pretend that they have a disability because maybe the only seats available in that section at the moment are the accessible seating. So a venue, how do they prevent fraud? And basically, of course, a venue cannot ask for proof of disability. They can ask for a verbal statement that if a person is buying an accessible seat for a single event, they can ask the individual if they, you know, need the accessible features of that location. If it is a subscription or series of event tickets, they can ask that the individual purchasing the tickets provide a written attestation that says basically that they or a member of their party have a mobility disability or a disability that requires the features of the accessible location. And again, I mean, it's the honor system. You know, a person who has the disability and needs those features is going to say, yes, you know, I'm a wheelchair user, yes, I need the accessible locations, or the person who's coming with me needs the accessible location. If a venue believes that a person is fraudulently purchasing the accessible locations, they can investigate. That may be, you know, a person without who doesn't need the features shows up game after game after game after game, and you know, they may at that point want to investigate, did that person acquire the tickets fraudulently or did they get them legitimately? So I think the burden to prevent fraud is really on the venues. Betty, I think from a venue standpoint, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
I think the burden is definitely on the venue to make every effort to prevent fraud. But again, the unintended consequences of this particular section in the new regulations really limits the venue's options for doing that. You have to tie it back to those other sections. I have to let in somebody. I have to honor the ticket if the patron acquired it from a person who's a wheelchair user under the section about transferring. I have to put my wheelchair accessible locations, at least some of them, if not all of them, online for purchase. And online, there's even fewer protections. I do have to make sort of a side note here, which is to say that you may find when you're purchasing wheelchair accessible locations online that you'll have to click a box that is an attestation that you actually need it. So it might say before you actually are allowed to purchase the tickets online, it may ask you the question of, this is just to confirm that you or a member of your party is a person with a mobility disability, et cetera. And that's the equivalent to the verbal attestation that I would be entitled to ask you over the phone as the venue. But if you think or suspect that there's fraud going on in the purchase of tickets, you're going to have to notify the venue. The venue is going to have to make a determination as to whether they have good cause, and if they do, they'll do their best to investigate the abuse of those tickets. But other than that, there isn't much the venue is going to be able to do. So this is a little bit of a tricky, sticky section here.
Right. Now, there's really no good solution to fraud, unfortunately.
No, I don't see a lot of fraud happening for Placido Domingo singing in La Boheme, but I think this is a much bigger issue when you're getting into the sports arenas, the big concert arenas, et cetera. For your general theater, I think there's not a lot of abuse going on. But in the larger venues, there may be, and your best bet is to inform the theater, the venue, the stadium, so that they can look into the fraud if they feel they have good cause to do so.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we've covered all of our sections now, so if anyone has questions.
At this time, we'll have Stephanie provide instructions to our participants by phone, and they can queue in to ask questions. And anyone who is using the online system, either the webinar platform and or the streaming audio, can please go ahead and submit your questions using those systems, and we'll relay them to the presenters. So, Stephanie, you want to give some instructions?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star then one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
While we're waiting for some folks to queue in some questions, I do have one that was submitted to me electronically by email and said that there was any concern, or do you think that there's any differences related to the use of paperless tickets now? So much, on the internet and such of that nature with fraud or other problems with people, purchasing and getting the right tickets and the right seats and things of that nature. Verification, this person saying they've had struggled with verification, they actually got the seat that they think they bought when they go to the paperless ticket type things where they don't necessarily have a piece of paper or something the same as you might traditionally had a ticket. Any thoughts on that from either of you?
This is Betty. I'll jump in on that one. I think that the proliferation of a variety of new ways to demonstrate that you've purchased tickets, the ability to sort of flash your iPhone at me, the ability to print at home tickets, all of these are leading to people are clever. They're going to figure out a way to try to beat the system, and so they are leading to new ways in which people are trying to scam the venues. If you print two of sets of your tickets at home and you take one copy that you printed and hand it off to another person, or you Xerox that copy and hand it off to another person, we could end up as the venue having 2, 4, 6 people all for one seat. And that is a concern of all the venues, and I think everybody right now is doing their best to deal with that form of fraud. I think it's not going to be any worse for the accessible seating. I think that the issue right now is that venues just have to get smarter than the people who are trying to outsmart them.
Great, thank you. Stephanie, are there questions from the telephone audience?
I'm please press the star then one key. Our next question comes from Debbie Jackson. Your line is open.
Hi, Betty. This is Debbie Jackson in Hawaii. I met you at the National ADA Symposium last week, and I have a question for you. If a venue, like the example that you gave with the orchestra seating and the mezzanine and the balcony, say that they can't get all of the accessible seating in the orchestra section, what does the venue do then?
Cleo might be able to help us with this question because this has to do with barrier removal.
An existing facility under the 1991 standards had to remove barriers to the extent that it was readily achievable and wasn't an undue burden. So that if the venue cannot get their full number of accessible seating based on the size of the facility, they have to get as many as they can in order to remove the barrier. And this is this barrier removal is assuming that it's not new construction since ADA went into effect, and it's there hasn't been alterations that would trigger accessibility requirement. It's strictly you have to go in and you have to remove barriers. So that, say, in Betty's example where she needed 8 wheelchair locations, if there was only room in that back row where there she could get the accessible route to the seats, and then you had the requirements for the seating in the companion seat, and the venue was only able to achieve 7 and they needed 8, but, you know, in barrier removal, they couldn't get that 8th seat anywhere else in the theater without, you know, doing a massive renovation. They wouldn't have to do it. But, again, you have to weigh what's readily achievable, what can be done, the configuration of the theater. You can't go to the next row in front because now the theater, the floor slopes, and you can't have an accessible location that slopes. It has to be level. So it's going to differ from venue to venue, and it's basically, you know, what is readily achievable when it comes to barrier removal.
I don't want people to think that this is an excuse. Barrier removal is not sort of a blanket exception for anybody. It means you have to try to get to the full number of seats you're required to get to under the appropriate standards, the 1991 or the 2010 accessible design standards. So I would push on any venue that doesn't have the minimum required number to see if they can't figure out a way to remove those barriers. Sometimes they won't be able to do it, but sometimes they can, and they've just been lazy. So if they don't have them and they can't get them, that's one thing. If they haven't bothered to try, that's another.
Right, and barrier removal is ongoing. So if, you know, it's been over 20 years, in 20 years a lot can be done. So if in the first 5 years after the ADA became effective, if they provided 3 wheelchair locations, that didn't stop their obligation to continue removing barriers till the point where they're, you know, fully accessible. And again, if they've undergone any renovation, the renovation that they've done needs to comply with the ADA and the accessibility guidelines.
Great. Well, that leads me into a question that's been submitted online here, and they're saying, do the new regulations still require a line of sight over standing spectators? So this is another architectural question, and I don't know, Cleo, if you want to step in and handle that particular inquiry.
Line of sight and dispersion is addressed in the design guidelines, and so the short answer is yes, that wheelchair spaces have to be dispersed. They have to have a choice of seating location and viewing angles that are equivalent to seats that are not the accessible seats. And if the venue has performances or games that where spectators are expected to stand, then the accessible locations have to have viewing angles over the standing spectators.
I think this is an issue in particular for sports stadiums and, again, large concert venues. I think the only time at the Kennedy Center that we really expect people to stand is during the Hallelujah Chorus, which we do once a year at Christmas time. So generally for the opera, there's not an expectation that we're going to have standing spectators. So this line of sight issue can vary depending on what the venue is like.
Great, thank you. And additional questions, please, Stephanie, from the queue.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star then one key.
Okay, I'm going to enter another question here that I've received. We get a lot of questions from people, you know, somewhat of a concern that the reduction that the architectural standards have done in the number of seats that are required in large venues is in direct conflict with the ability now for an individual to buy three contiguous, additional seats. And so with fewer wheelchair seating seats architecturally required under the standards and such, do you foresee or do you think or know or could give any background on potential how this might impact the reduction in the number in contrast to the number of seats I can now purchase and potentially taking up wheelchair accessible seats with people who do not need the wheelchair accessible seat because of the way that the regulation is written?
This is Betty. I'm gonna the regulations, that particular change in the standards, the new ADA standards, really hits venues at 5,000 seats and above. I've done the numbers. I've run numbers for different sized venues, and the reduction in the number of wheelchair accessible locations for venues under 5,000 seats is really not significant. There is a reduction, though, when you get up to those higher numbers. And Cleo, you've worked more with stadiums and the really, really large venues. Do you see a significant change happening there?
They have basically reduced by half in the larger venues, the ones that are over the 5,000.
Right.
But there were a lot of use studies that Department of Justice looked at, and a lot of the location, the full 1% was not being utilized. Now with the reduction and the way each venue is configured, I think there could be an impact, especially in the example that we had used earlier where the three companions are now taking over wheelchair locations by infilling with the removable seats. So I think that larger venues really need to start looking at that to see how the new regulation and the reduced numbers and with the advent of the three companions is going to impact the accessible seating locations to see, how many people are, in fact, turned away, if any, because we don't have the numbers. We had the numbers based on purely one wheelchair user, one companion, and in the larger venues, the seats were not being fully used. But now with the addition of two extra companions, how is that going to impact it? And I think, 3 years down the road, I would be really interested in seeing the numbers. And, if it does impact it significantly, maybe advocacy groups go back to Department of Justice and try to figure out what will be equitable at that point.
There's a chance that there will be a huge impact in smaller venues. We have to remember that the designers, our architects, built all these venues with the idea of one companion seat, one wheelchair, one companion seat, one wheelchair. And when there's not always the flexibility to find the additional two companion seats without having to use up a wheelchair location. So I do think that I personally have some concerns about the availability of wheelchair accessible locations. On the other hand, the reason why they allowed for those three additional companion seats is because there was so much pressure and outcry from the disability community, which I think was perfectly valid, saying, we don't want to when I come, I want to sit with my friends. If I'm a grandparent, I want to sit with my two grandchildren. I don't want to have to sit separate from them. The combination, I think, of the reduction in the number of wheelchair locations being required under the design standards and then the increase in the number of companion seats is not the best combination.
Yeah, and I think because they were done separately, one done by the accessibility guidelines developed by the AOS Access Board and the second was a regulatory change made by the Department of Justice, I think that, is where some of that disconnect, does occur in that. Do we have any additional questions through the telephone line, Stephanie?
Yes, our next question comes from Rick Edwards. Your line is open.
Go ahead.
My question is, my name is Daniel Pittman. I'm legally blind, and I was wondering, there was mention about accessibility for visually impaired and low vision. How would that be accommodated for somebody with my limited vision being able to be able to see any kind of event? How would that accommodation be done?
This is Betty. I'll start and then let Cleo take over because I want to do the easy part of that question. Just so you know, Dan, these regulations in the first section specifically say that the only thing these new regulations are addressing are the wheelchair accessible locations. They are not addressing the issues of patrons who are deaf and hard of hearing or patrons who are blind or have low vision. That does not mean that the venue is relieved of any obligation to you. It just means that under these regulatory changes, these new regulations, you're not covered here. But, Cleo, I think they still have an obligation under just the general modification of policies, practices, and procedures to make an effort to accommodate patrons who are blind or have low vision.
Right. No, I agree. It's, you're going to trigger reasonable accommodation. What does the individual need? What does the venue have to offer? And I think more and more venues are looking at patrons and fans that have disabilities that affect vision and, do have accommodations. So definitely call the venue box office, tell them what you need, and, try to work through it to get the seat location that you need.
I think that this is Robin, a little bit of a disconnect between some of the things that the Department of Justice is putting out and the guidance to venues, and it really is left up to the venues to figure out how those accommodations are made, because the Department of Justice has not necessarily supported even a requirement for set-aside seating or for reduction of any ticket prices or first opportunity for the first row at if you're in an orchestra and that's the closest seating and that's a $200 ticket, there's nothing in the ADA regulations at this time that would require that they sell a cheaper ticket to someone because they needed that closer location. And that's where there continues, I think, to be some advocacy needs within the various communities to look at potential future changes in the regulations for more language and more guidance to the venues on this particular issue, because it really is left up to venue by venue as to how they operationalize this, and there isn't much in the regulatory language that really requires them to do anything, especially when it comes to pricing and things like that. Additional questions, Stephanie?
I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Okay, I have one that was submitted by electronically related to the accessibility of the websites. We really didn't talk about that from a protection. The accessibility is two different things. It's accessibility to be able to get in there and find the seat I need, accessibility. But then there's the accessibility of that with somebody who may be using assistive technologies and such to be able to navigate the websites. Betty or Cleo, can you say or address that at all in regards to any leverage that the new regulations give to ensuring the accessibility of the web-based ticketing process?
Definitely the regulations are pretty clear, even though they never use the term online or web. In the regulatory language, if you go to the appendix and you look at the Department of Justice's discussion with itself about why it's making certain choices, it says it thinks that web accessibility has always been covered by the ADA, but that's not the regulatory language. So that leaves us kind of hanging here, wondering exactly what's going on. I think a lot of people, including me in the disability community, feel that web accessibility is covered and that we need to ensure that the actual ticket buying process is accessible to screen readers and people using alternative means of access to the information. Cleo, do you have anything that might clarify that situation?
I agree with what you say, Betty, and I think there have been some cases based on web sites of different kinds of accommodations and settlements that Department of Justice has entered into, but I do believe that they do have to be accessible, and that venues and entities that do transact business through a website or online or however you want to say it do have to take into account screen readers and other kinds of accommodations that they need to take into account. So if there's a photo on the website, then it should be coded in the background so the screen reader can say, you know, it's a photo of such and such a theater or whatever. So I think that venues need to look at their websites and their resources and make sure that they accommodate everyone.
Yeah, but just to play devil's advocate a little bit, remember, there's nothing in the regulations, because in 1991 we weren't thinking about Internet access and web accessibility. There's nothing in the regulations that talks specifically or says so cleanly in black and white, yes, your website must be accessible. The Department of Justice just had out an advance notice of proposed rulemaking that actually asked people to comment on that specific issue, with the thought in mind that in the near future, the Department of Justice would be issuing new regulations that would specifically address the issue of web accessibility.
Right, and spell out and how to do it and have, you know, better guidelines. But I think venues just need to keep that in mind and be conscious that it is, there is technology out there now, and look at it, because, you know, someone may complain, and if they complain to a court or Department of Justice, you know, who's going to prevail? I just think it's wise to start taking into account now. Technology's come a long way in the last 22 years.
And I think this is Robin. Just you have to say it should be approached similar to, like, you're building a building or renovating a building. It's not something you can do overnight, because anyone who's worked with websites knows that there's a structure to the website and there's a way that things are added and done, and you can't just go in and, you know, magically tweak it to suddenly become accessible. It is like building a structure, and it does take planning, and it does take an infrastructure. You know, there's an architecture to websites that definitely needs to be addressed. So in that regard, sorry about that. I've got a line ringing here. That regard is supposed to be addressed. So.
Right. Yeah, I agree, Robin. And so if you do have a web designer or you're looking at upgrading your site, you know, ask them about, you know, are there technologies out there that would just serve my constituents better? You know, we're all in customer service, so the more customers you serve, the better.
And ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, if you have a question at this time, please press the star then one key.
Okay, as we proceed and wait to see.
I'm showing no further questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. As we just finalize here, you'll see some resources that have been provided by our speakers. U.S. Department of Justice Civil Rights Division Disability Rights Section, their website, www.ada.gov. And you'll see their phone number, 800-514-0301, voice. Just wanted to also, for anyone, the TTY number for the Department of Justice Civil Rights Section is 800-514-0383 for TTY direct access. Also encourage you to contact the ADA National Network, also known as the DBTAC, Disability Business and Technical Assistance Centers. We are geographically located across the country and are funded by the federal government and available to respond to your questions or direct you to the areas that you may be able to get some answers to your questions. So, again, we already went through the questions, so this particular slide is a moot point. Our presenters, this is how you go ahead and get in touch with them. They have provided you with their contact information, very brave souls that they are to do that. Feel free to email them or telephone or email as you see provided to you here, and they'll respond to your questions as they're able to if you have any particular issues that you might want to bring forward to them. As I said, the session was recorded today, and we will be making it available on our website within approximately 10 days at www.ada-audio.org. We invite you to join us at next month's ADA audio conference session, which is titled Reasonable Accommodation. And it features Dr. Ellen Fabian and Dr. Kim McDonald, who both are associated with the Mid-Atlantic ADA Center and the University of Maryland. And they will be discussing the issues of reasonable accommodation. So we invite you, same time, same place. You can get more information and register at the website, again, www.ada-audio.org. At this time, I would like to thank our presenters, both Cleo and Betty, for their time and their expertise. Today, these are very complex issues that everyone is really, struggling to get through. And I don't want to say struggle, that's a negative. I think are working to get through. These did go into effect in March of this past year, with only a month or so ago. So they are in effect right now. So these are issues that are impacting you as you're getting your summer together and looking at all the concerts and all of the events and venues and buying up your championship tickets for, you know, whatever team you might be cheering on for right now in the playoffs or whatever else it might be. This is all current and it is in effect right now. And one of the things that we're finding out with the new ticketing regulations that many venues have started to have kind of aha moments about other areas of the ADA that they may not have been in compliance with that the new regulations have really highlighted. Again, the seating issues, they've never really addressed fully their, seating and where it's positioned and such in their venues and things. So you might still continue to find, even though we say 20 years later, that a lot of these things should have been resolved. I think that every time we do tweaks or changes to the ADA regulations, we do find that there's a cadre of people out there who are not fully up on what the ADA required even before these changes. So this is an area that many of you still may find frustrations with, but hopefully you'll find also at the same time some success in getting better seating and some better information about the seats that you're seeking to sit in. So thank you very much, everyone, for joining us today. You will receive an email shortly after the session to your registration with the evaluation information, online evaluation. We do encourage you to complete it for us. We do value your feedback. So thank you very much, and have a good rest of your day.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. You may all disconnect and have a wonderful day.